Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We talk about the world's stock markets as if each were its own little island. But most of the time, really, it's one big happy market out there. What happens in London can affect Tokyo. A crash in Shanghai, well, we learned in February what that can do to Wall Street. Nothing good. So traders were braced for the worst when they woke up today to the news that Shanghai was off 6.5% overnight. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday. It's the 30th of May. The beauty of the space-time continuum is that when everything works out right, we can get tomorrow's news today. The Shanghai Stock Exchange opened for trading at 9:15 in the morning Wednesday, China time. That was 9:15 last night on the U.S. East Coast, so American investors had plenty of time to adjust to what could well have been the market-moving news of the day. Beijing's desperate to let some of the air out of China's stock market. So yesterday morning, right before the open, it tripled the tax rate on stock trades. The Shanghai Composite Index tumbled 6.5% in response. Unlike February, though, this time Wall Street just shrugged itself all the way to a couple of record closes, actually. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on the Chinese markets.
An average of 300,000 new accounts are open for traders in China's soaring stock market every day. But the Chinese government is trying to let a little air out of a possible stock market bubble. The bubble did deflate a bit, but Kevin Kneeler of the Scowcroft Group says today's drop wasn't big enough to panic U.S. investors.
You'd have to see a move in excess of 20 or 30% before foreign investors would start to have a fundamental reassessment of the attraction of China stocks.
And China stocks are more attractive than ever to the Chinese. Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says they saw today's market drop as a buying opportunity.
Part of the problem in China is there aren't a lot of things to invest in. The stock market is the new toy. It's hot. Everybody wants in.
The Chinese government has tried to slow down the economy for the same reason the U.S. Federal Reserve strives for balanced growth. Like us, China is worried about inflation. So Beijing has raised interest rates and ordered banks to hold more currency in reserve and away from speculative investors. Jacques Delisle of the Foreign Policy Research Institute says the government is walking a fine line economically and politically.
It's essentially the deal they've struck will make you rich if you keep fairly quiet politically, which requires a high growth rate. But if it overheats, then you run the risk of possibly the popping of a speculative bubble.
This is an especially tricky time for China's communist leaders. There's a key party meeting later this year. A bursting stock bubble would ruin the party for everyone. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I mentioned records. The Dow set another one today. The S&P 500 finally topped its dot-com high, too. Shares in Pfizer slipped about 0.5%. We learned today the world's biggest drug maker is facing criminal charges in Nigeria. They're related to a 1996 clinical trial. The company's accused in the deaths of children who received an unapproved antibiotic. A separate lawsuit is seeking more than $2 billion in damages, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The Nigerian lawsuit alleges that Pfizer researchers did not get consent from the children's families. It goes on to suggest that company officials knew that the drug in question, called Trovan, can have life-threatening side effects. Though the clinical trial took place more than 10 years ago, Nigerian officials say they waited until now because they only recently learned details through a series of stories in the Washington Post. The issues here are not isolated to Africa.
Studies do show that in developing countries, informed and voluntary consent is often not met, sort of on a routine basis.
That's Sonia Shah, author of The Body Hunters, testing new drugs on the world's poorest patients.
There's very few patients in the Western markets these days that are willing to be experimental subjects for clinical trials. In developing countries where people don't have as good access to health care, they're much more willing to line up for these clinical trials.
Pfizer, in a statement to the Washington Post, said it thinks it did nothing wrong. The company adds that the 1996 clinical study was conducted with the full knowledge of the Nigerian government. So, could the negative PR hurt the company? Heather Brilliant is a senior equity analyst with Morningstar.
People could be concerned that drug companies, including Pfizer, were doing this on a more widespread basis. I do not expect that will come out of this case at all.
Brilliant doesn't expect the case will hurt the company's bottom line.
Ultimately, I don't think it will have a very significant impact on Pfizer.
Pfizer did not respond to requests for an interview prior to deadline. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Now, here's a tricky one. How do you sue the CIA? The answer is you really don't, at least not in cases where the government can claim something called the state secrets privilege. So the American Civil Liberties Union is trying something else. The ACLU has been trying to hold the government accountable for what it calls the illegal kidnapping of suspected terrorists. The group claims innocent people have been flown off to secret overseas prisons where they've been systematically tortured. Having had no luck in court against the CIA itself, today the ACLU tried something new. It sued a division of Boeing. Marketplace's Bob Moon explains.
The slogan of Boeing's Jeppesen Data Plan Division is making every mission possible. The ACLU says the firm made it possible for the CIA to carry out a clandestine program known as Extraordinary Rendition, snatching terror suspects in foreign countries and spiriting them off to secret locations. Jeppesen's business is providing customers with flight plans that include navigational headings and fuel requirements, but that's as much as Boeing spokesman Tim Neal would tell us today.
The flight planning services that Jeppesen provides to its clients are all provided on a confidential basis. And so we really aren't at liberty to talk about customers or identify who Jeppesen's customers are without their permission.
The ACLU cites an article in the New Yorker magazine. It quoted a senior Jeppesen official as telling an internal board meeting that the company was planning all of what he allegedly called the torture flights. ACLU attorney Stephen Watts says there's no way the firm couldn't have known what was going on.
They had their head in the sand if alarm bells were not being raised that there was something untoward here. And what we're alleging is that knowingly, Jeppesen aided the CIA in their torture and indefinite detention.
Proving that in court is another matter, and the ACLU may never even get the chance. Today's action may ultimately amount to little more than the legal equivalent of shouting and pointing. Duke University professor Scott Silliman says the CIA is likely to invoke the government's state secrets privilege. It's been recognized by the courts since World War II and is virtually automatic.
When they do that, the judge can quite probably shut the lawsuit down rather than risk getting involved in state secrets.
The ACLU's attorney told us the organization is prepared to fight that move vigorously. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The day did end with records on Wall Street, but between the opening and closing bells, there was a whole lot of trading going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. No company likes its dirty laundry being aired in public, especially a company like Walmart. And yet, especially not on the front of the business pages of the New York Times. Though that's exactly where the company found itself today, reporter Michael Barbaro got his hands on a report criticizing Walmart's so far unsuccessful attempt to climb out of the bargain basement. Michael Barbaro, what does this report say?
What this report says is that a lot of the things that Walmart is most proud of, it's all-in-one shopping format, it's unbelievably wide selection, are actually not very good for Walmart when it comes to trying to sell fancy things like dresses and fancy televisions. And that's a surprise to Walmart, and I don't think they anticipated this. The things that they value most might actually hurt them as they try to go upscale.
Are they just not doing it right, or is it a matter of the customer associating Walmart with not upscale goods?
It's a combination of both things. For one thing, they've made some big miscalculations. They carried some very, very tight jeans, for example, that don't fit a lot of their customers who tend to be heftier. And then their customers don't think of them for tight jeans. possibly because they're heftier, possibly because they buy them at Kohl's and at JCPenney's and at Target. So it's a combination of Walmart screwing up a little bit and customers not thinking of them for things like fashion.
This isn't a Walmart report. Who wrote it?
This is definitely not a Walmart report, and it's not a report that Walmart wanted to get at. It was written by their advertising firm called GSD&M. It's based in Texas, and they've worked with Walmart for about 20 years. They know Walmart inside and out. But Walmart was about to search for a new advertising firm, and this company wrote this report as part of an effort to remain Walmart's advertising firm.
And did they?
They didn't. It's not clear that it's because Walmart didn't like what this report said. But in any event, Walmart chose different advertising firms to do all of its marketing.
You cover retail, and you've been doing so for a while. So let me ask you a subjective question. Do you think it's worth it for Walmart to try to go upscale when it's got such a lock on that lower-end market?
It absolutely does make sense for Walmart to go into this business, and anybody would tell you that. And here's why. When you've got a lock on a market, you can't take it for granted. You've got to go someplace else. And Walmart certainly has a lock on low-income consumers and really basic products. But they need to grow, like any company. And in order to grow, they have to go after a market they don't have. It's a market Target's done very well with, JCPenney's, Kohl's, and they want a piece of it.
Okay, so how long is it going to take, do you think, for Walmart to get it right?
It's going to take longer than Walmart thought it would, and it's going to take longer than Walmart's competitors thought it would. When Walmart first decided it was going to go upscale, everybody was freaked out. Now they realize that they don't have as much to be worried about in the immediate future.
Obviously, we've caught you on a cell phone. You're headed down, as a matter of fact, to Bentonville for the Walmart annual shareholder meeting Friday, right?
Friday morning, bright and early.
Well, how do you think that's going to go? What do you think the response is going to be as this strategy comes up really for the first time at a shareholder meeting?
Well, I think a lot of people are looking for Walmart to tell them how this upscale strategy is doing, and I think Walmart will be very candid and say that it's a pretty mixed bag. And people are going to look for an explanation of whether it makes sense to keep doing this and at what pace Walmart's going to keep doing this. And people are also going to look for some sort of solution to the problem, whether it means scaling it back, changing the clothing they have, changing the people who are doing the buying, and maybe making other changes at the highest levels of the company, because this has been a real black mark against Walmart for the past 6 months or so.
Michael Barbaro from the New York Times. He's on his way down to Bentonville for the Walmart meeting on Friday. Mr. Barbaro, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's almost as if you can take anything you like, throw it at the U.S. stock market, and have absolutely nothing bad happen. Take your pick, whether it's the spillover from the Chinese markets that we talked about up at the top of the program, or the housing market and its seemingly endless tumble, American investors keep on buying. Commentator Robert Reich says if you really want to understand why the stock market continues to be bullish, you have to go back to Econ 101.
When the supply of something decreases, while the demand for it stays up, its price rises. Here, I'm talking about supply and demand in publicly traded stocks. In case you hadn't noticed, corporate America and Wall Street are in the process of privatizing a growing portion of America's stock market. It's happening in two ways. First, cash-rich companies are finding they can boost their stock prices faster by buying back their shares of stock than by investing in new factories, equipment, or research and development. After IBM announced it was repurchasing another $15 billion of its stock last month, for example, the value of its publicly traded shares rose. Meanwhile, private equity firms are doing a record amount of leveraged buyouts, that is, taking publicly traded companies private. That's what Cerberus Capital did 2 weeks ago with Chrysler. Now look at the big picture. Last year, corporate buybacks and leveraged buyouts totaled about $600 billion. That was roughly 3.5% of the whole value of the American stock market. At the rate buybacks and buyouts are going this year, the total is going to be close to about $900 billion. That's another 4.5% of U.S. market capitalization taken out of circulation. With the supply of publicly traded shares shrinking like this, and with lots of global money out there to buy the shares that remain, it's no wonder the stock market is going like gangbusters. Yet at some point, this bubble will burst. You see, the whole reason for companies buying back their shares and for private equity firms doing leveraged buyouts is to put all these shares of stock back onto the public market at some point in the future at a higher price than before. But if stock prices are now rising largely because the supply of publicly traded shares is shrinking, and if companies aren't really investing for the future, what happens when all this stock comes back on the market? The loud thud you'll hear will be the sound of shares falling back to earth.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. He's now a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Your comments are always welcome. Send them through our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the source of sushi.
I mean, what's amazing is that, you know, we don't know which ocean much of the stuff has come from, and really the answer could be that it could come from any of them.
But first, let's do the numbers. At China News, we talked about it, and a whole bunch of big deals had Wall Street on a wild ride this Wednesday, but it did have a happy ending. The Dow Industrials bucked up 111 points, 0.8% to close out the day at 13,633. The NASDAQ galloped ahead 20 points, 0.8% to finish at 2592. The S&P 500 loped forward 12 points, wait for it, yes, 0.8% to end at 1530. Those mighty markets seem to just keep getting mightier. We're talking about the businesses that run the markets now. Intercontinental Exchange shot up 0.2% after penning a deal that brings it closer to sewing up a merger with CBOT. That's the group that operates the Chicago Board of Trade. That had all the market stocks hopping. CBOT leapt 0.2%. The NASDAQ jumped 5.25%. That's the market itself. And NYSE Euronext skipped up 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for April. President Bush speaks on the U.S. International Development Agenda. And tomorrow is World No Tobacco Day. This year's theme, smoke-free environments. So stub them out outside. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Over in Brussels today, the European Union told food and beverage makers they need to do more to stop obesity. About 15 million Europeans are considered overweight or obese. Millions more than that live in the U.S. Both state and local governments are trying to make us thinner. But as Americans get bigger, losing weight becomes a bigger business. The diet industry is a multi-billion dollar enterprise, one whose existence depends on our failures. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk.
One mark of the growth in the American girth is the weight of diet books that land on my desk. The metabolic pan. Fat is not your fate. The body shape solution to weight loss. Shrink yourself. The reality diet. Curves. The Duke diet. About $300 worth of books, but just a tiny proportion of the cash the weight loss industry rakes in.
Well, the diet industry is amazing. It's really a $40 billion ripoff.
Craig Pepin-Donat was a personal trainer and head of marketing for the 24-hour fitness chain. He has a book of his own to point out the diet industry's failings, The Big Fat Health and Fitness Lie.
There are about 70 million people who resolve to lose weight each year. 70 million. Yet, less than 5% of those people will actually attain lasting results.
Many of us can relate. Losing weight's easy, goes the joke. I've lost 10 pounds dozens of times. That was Brandy Mancuso's experience. She says she tried everything.
Oh, the miracle pills that don't work. I did the Trim Spa, Nutrisystem, Jenny Craig, Weight Watchers, exercise tapes, exercise equipment, gym memberships. and none of it worked.
Mancuso reckoned she spent as much as $20,000 trying to lose weight over the last decade. Surgery was what ultimately worked for her. One reason that people find losing weight so hard is that the most powerful market pressures are pushing us to get ever fatter. That's the view of Bill Weiss, professor of management at Seattle University.
But the big losers, if we were to stop getting fatter and fatter, would be fast food, soda, junk food sources. Those are the big ones, and they have market power.
Weiss says the U.S. food industry produces about 3,800 calories of food a day for every American, twice what we need, then spends millions of advertising dollars persuading us to eat it. No wonder we're chubby. That, in turn, feeds the diet industry's financial success. Market research company Market Data reckons Americans will spend nearly $60 billion trying to lose weight this year. Of course, commercial weight loss systems really do work for some people. Take 61-year-old Mary Lou Lenehan. She runs a daycare in Massachusetts.
Jenny Craig is the only one that I have any success with, and I have very good success with.
It costs her, but she says it's well worth it.
I buy the food every week from them, and you can pick your own menu, and you pick out what you want, and food is very, very good. And now it costs me about $50 a week.
Call 1-800-JENNY-20 today and lose 20 pounds for $20 plus the cost of food.
Have you called Jenny yet?
Nutrition experts are ambivalent about commercial weight loss programs. Miriam Nelson of Tufts University.
There are some that have been around for a longer period of time and have a good track record. There are others that make an awful lot of money by selling food. And those are the ones that make me a little bit more nervous because I think that people should be able to eat their own food.
Nelson says the truth is there is no magic weight loss pill or formula. But it can be done.
The diet that works best is the one that you enjoy the most and are more likely to stick with. So in the end, it's very difficult to lose weight. You have to eat less and you have to exercise more. Basically, that's the formula.
Which, of course, we all know and don't need a book to tell us. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
The daily deadlines around here make it tough for us to get out for lunch most days, ever, in fact. But sometimes a story comes along that you make an exception for. The other day, I met a guy named Sasha Eisenberg at a sushi bar over in Little Tokyo, about a mile or so from the studio.
Moriowase. Just ordered a standard assortment, what they call moriowase in Japanese, that sort of traditional 10 or so pieces.
Sasha says he's got pretty good sushi bar Japanese, but it's really more than just a party trick. He spent 2 years researching and writing his new book, The Sushi Economy, over some truly excellent tuna and sea urchin. We talked about the role raw fish has in the world economy and how sushi came to be popular here in the United States.
We're at Sushi Gen in Little Tokyo in downtown Los Angeles. Sushi as a business lunch is really how the bar came to be. And the first sushi bar opened in Los Angeles in 1962, and the first generation of people to come were the corporate expats and business travelers and tourists with Japanese money.
Let's look at a piece that's on the plate here. We've got a piece of bluefin tuna. Where has it been? Where did it come from?
It could be coming in the summer months from the Atlantic or the Mediterranean. Could have been ranched off the coast of Spain. It could have been caught by a fisherman off of Cape Cod. It could have come from the North Pacific waters off of Japan. What's amazing is that, you know, we don't know which ocean much of the stuff has come from, and really the answer could be that it could come from any of them. But it could have been shipped fresh, on ice, come over by air. It also could have been frozen at negative 70 degrees in a nitrogen-chilled freezer, and it moved its way through a cold storage supply chain for the last 18 months. You know, the chef may know. It's quite possible the chef may not know.
Speed is key here.
Yes. I mean, not just against other commodities, but if you look at other high-value food products, tuna loses more value more quickly than any other. I mean, if you have truffles, they'll do fine on a shelf for a while. Your wine is probably only going to increase in value with age. And if you don't find the right buyer for your tuna on a couple days after it's caught, it's going to go to waste.
Sushi has become really sort of a really good tool to look at globalization. It's this single fish that somehow makes its way via modern conveniences and incredible technology to dinner plates and sushi bars all over the world.
You have these two elements. You have the globalization of supply, which is the new cargo connections, especially jet travel, the ability of people to move capital around the world quickly enough to turn over these rapid transactions in this valuable but decaying product. Simple things like fishermen having satellite phones so they can call in their catch, and the guy at the dock in some out-of-the-way third-world harbor having a fax machine so he can get a daily sales report from an auction at a fish market in Tokyo and know what it's worth. And then you have the sort of globalization of culture or of taste that has created appetites for this sort of peculiar Japanese delicacy all over the world.
It is, in a lot of ways, sort of contrary to the image we have of globalization, you know, which is factory workers in some developing country in a sweatshop stitching garments or soccer balls. It's more high-tech, it's more complex, and in a way it's different in its end result in that it's actually something we consume.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I wanted to break down this idea that we've been left with sort of two options in as food culture and business generally go global, that you either have the intimate local ties to the farmer's market or you have the impersonal global option of McDonald's. And the fact is that the sushi economy is this quintessentially global industry that couldn't exist without the sort of revolutions in technology and finance that of the last generation. And yet it still relies on the type of interpersonal relationships and human trust and local knowledge that we think has disappeared.
No soy sauce.
Americans really don't do sushi right, do we?
I sort of wanted to call into question the whole idea of doing it right. I mean, the fact is that sushi is this really modern innovation in Japan. It started as a street snack in Tokyo in the 19th century. The sushi bar as an institution didn't really develop until the 1960s. You know, tuna was considered a trash fish, save for pet food or marinated beyond recognition.
Yellowtail already.
I believe that's some hamachi, yellowtail. And so sushi's almost always been in flux and changing, and we're doing it as right as the Japanese are.
Sasha Eisenberg's new book is called The Sushi Economy.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, New York's yellow cabs are iconic, but their numbers are limited, as you know if you've ever been stuck in the rain looking for a ride. There's a total of 13,000 licenses doled out to taxi companies in the Big Apple, and the price for one of those licenses, or medallions as they call them, has hit a record. Two were bought this week for $600,000 apiece. That's more than double the record set back in 2001, and yet you still can't find a cab in the rain. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The Dow soared 111 points today, about 0.8%. The new mark is 13,633. The NASDAQ jumped 20 points, also 0.8%. The S&P 500 was up 12 points, oddly enough, 0.8% there. The new record's now 1530 on the S&P. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba. Next time on the program, when big business self-regulates.
We emit almost 100 million tons of CO2. We have a special responsibility to go to work on this issue and come up with solutions.
It's another edition of Conversations from the Corner Office. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.